Welcome to Peak Tales, a conversation about chromatography. Now here's your host, John.
Hey, Peak Tales listeners, welcome back. This is season 3 of the Peak Tales podcast. Yeah, I can't believe that we've already seen 2 seasons behind us, but we are certainly going to continue to provide you great content. And take a listen to today's episode. Listen on through the end. We will have a special promotion code for you, the loyal listeners. So get set and get ready, because here we go.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Peak Tales podcast. This is John. I am here today with Rita, and Rita is going to be talking to us about updating your HPLC method. In particular, we're going to be talking about updating isocratic methods and what that means for your chromatography. So good day, Rita. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, John. Thanks. How are you?
Good, good. And what are some of the reasons that people might want to update an isocratic method?
Well, people decide to update methods for a number of reasons. One could be the number of samples you need to analyze may have increased over time. So you may decide you need to speed up the separation to keep up with the workload. With newer column and instrumentation technologies, you may decide you want to improve your results. Maybe your resolution wasn't as good as you wanted, it's barely meeting your criteria, so it may make sense to take advantage of the new technologies and update it. You may also have a new formulation and need to adjust the method you had been using. Another reason may be that you inherited a method from someone and you're having trouble reproducing it. If you're going to have to put work into making that method work anyway, it could be a good time to decide it would be beneficial to update that to a new column, perhaps something shorter or with a smaller particle size.
Yeah, we see this often, right? People mm-hmm. have a method yep. that they inherited, in
yes.
quotes, they can't see us here, but that could have been run on a much older instrument, right, with a different
True.
Flow path, with a different volumes and whatnot. Now, all of a sudden, this is not behaving the way it's written to behave. So yeah. Are there questions we should be asking ourselves before we decide to update a method?
Yes, there certainly are. A good question to start with is, what's your goal? Are you looking for that faster separation to be able to handle a higher sample load? Do you need the better resolution, or is it some combination where you're going to compromise some maybe on resolution to have the faster separation or vice versa? Another key question to ask is it worth it? How many samples are you running on your current method? If the answer is 5 or 6 and you're just doing it once or twice a year, then the answer is probably it's not going to be worth it. If, on the other hand, you are seeing a higher sample throughput need and you're just getting bogged down in the number of samples and maybe even falling behind sometimes, then it's definitely worth considering the effort and the cost it takes to improve it. Another thing to think about or ask is, will it be used for a long period of time? If it's just a one-off type of thing that you're going to be doing to verify something, then no. But if the answer is yes, we're planning on using this method for years to come, then again, that could be worth the effort and the cost to update it.
So were there times when we can't update a method or it just doesn't make sense?
Well, in some cases, if you have a validated method or depending on how your method is written, it may not allow for changes. And that's something you have to consider, because if it's a validated method and you have to go back through the revalidation process, again, that's a considerable amount of effort and time and cost associated with that. So that may be a case where you just decide it's not worth it. But also, updating your method may require instrumentation that you don't have. For instance, if you're going to be trying a UHPLC column on a 400 bar instrument, it may not work because the UHPLC column requires a higher pressure limit than perhaps your existing instrumentation does. So it may not be worth the, doing that because you're not going to be able to capitalize on the benefits of going to a UHPLC type column. Like I mentioned earlier, if you're only running a few samples a year, it just may not be worth the time or the cost to update that, and that's a key thing to keep in mind too.
Okay, so how do we go about updating a method?
When we're talking about changing the column, and that's the part that we're going to focus on today, we typically look at changing dimensions, particle size, or both. If you want to improve your resolution, you can keep the column dimensions the same as what you currently have, but go to a smaller particle size. When you do that, your efficiency is going to increase because of the smaller particle size, and your resolution will improve as well. A key thing to remember, though, is efficiency is not directly proportional to resolution. So although you can increase your resolution some, it's not going to be directly proportional to the amount of efficiency you gain by going to the smaller particle size. It's also, again, important to remember that the pressure is going to increase as you go to smaller particle size, so you need to think about your instrumentation and make sure it can handle that increased pressure as well. Another thing we can do, we can change our column dimensions by reducing the length, the diameter, or both. If we change the length, we see a proportional change in the analysis time when we're doing running an isocratic method. For example, going from a 150 millimeter column to a 75 millimeter column will reduce the analysis time by 50%. When we do that, though, of course, we lose efficiency unless we change the column particle size to offset the difference in the length. There's an easy example that I like to use, and it starts with a 4.6 by 250 millimeter 5 micron column, which is a very common column that is used in classic HPLC methods. These are the types of methods that we're often wanting to update. That column has essentially the same efficiency as a 150 millimeter 3.5 micron column. So if you were to make that switch, the resulting separation on the 150 millimeter column would take just 3/5 of the time it took on that 250 millimeter column. So that can be a very easy, quick change, and you'll get the same separation just at the reduced analysis time. Another thing we can change is the column ID. This can help us save solvent, and of course that's going to help save money. When we change the ID, we can change the flow rate to keep the same linear velocity as on the original ID column, and that's important. So for instance, when we go from a 4.6 millimeter ID column running at 1 mil per minute to a 3 millimeter ID column, we change the flow rate to 0.42 mils per minute to maintain the same linear velocity. To calculate the flow rate for a new column, in this case the 3 millimeter ID, you take the square of the ratio of column 2 divided by column 1 and multiply it by the original flow rate, which was 1 mil per minute, and that will give us 0.42 mils per minute. This saves solvent, but if you're saving solvent doing that, you may also decide you want to run at a higher flow rate to help reduce your analysis time even more. So if you run it 2 times the flow rate, you can reduce your runtime by half. So a combination of things like that can really help you increase your throughput. Key thing to remember, when you change your column ID, you also want to adjust your injection volume proportionally, though, so you don't overload your column. So always keep that in mind. And of course, you can use a combination of length, diameter, and particle size to get the separation that works best for you. And that's just something that's going to take time and effort on your part, but it can be well worth it.
Yeah, that's why they call it an experiment, right, Rita?
That's right.
Sometimes you have to, through trial and error and changing different variables, get to the endpoint that's going to be most desirable. Are there any other things that we need to be thinking about here?
Yes, one of the things that can often come into play when we're changing column particle size, it may mean you need to change to a different column chemistry to take advantage of new column technology and find the best column for your updated method. When we talk about our columns here at Agilent, we have our traditional Zorbex chemistries, and they have been used a lot for those 4.6 by 255 micron classic methods. And you can always go to a smaller particle size, like the 3.5 micron or 1.8 micron in that same family, and expect to get the same separation, because they're the same column chemistries, and they're all totally porous. But we also have some other options, too. We have our superficially porous Infinity Lab pore shell columns. We have the Infinity Lab pore shell columns that align with many of our Zorbex chemistries to simplify method transfer from fully porous particles like those classic 4.6 by 255 micron ones, and being able to transfer them to Infinity Lab pore shell options. And we do have most of them, of our key Zorbex ones, do align with the similar chemistries within the pore shell line of columns. And that we have information on that we can help you with. Okay, we have Infinity Lab pore shell columns that align with many of our Zorbex chemistries to simplify method transfer from fully porous particles to superficially porous particles. We have selectivity posters for both the Zorbex chemistries and the Infinity Lab pore shell options that include that information on how they align with each other. In closing, I also want to mention another publication that you may find helpful. It's a technical overview we have that talks more about transferring methods from totally porous to superficially porous columns. And we will have information on all of those in our show notes.
Absolutely, Rita. Thank you. Yeah, obviously, to give out a bunch of show notes on the podcast at this point, you know, sometimes it's a little difficult to remember them all, but they'll be there in the show notes for you. A ton of resources that Rita's pointing to. And in addition, if you want to, you know, go back and re-listen to this episode, take some notes, that's certainly perfect in the format that we're doing this in. But again, thank you, Rita. We're going to have you back on for another episode where we'll be talking about upgrading gradient methods, and that will probably be our next episode. Thanks for joining us today, Rita.
Thank you. Thanks. It was fun.
Okay, thank you for listening to this episode. I promised I'd be back with a special promotion code for loyal listeners. I'll have that to you in just 1 minute. But I did want to mention, as we have launched into season 3, we do need your feedback. So send an email to peaktales, all one word, peaktales, at agilent.com. with suggestions for episodes, and we'd be more than happy to look them over and get your question on the show. Okay, so here's the promo code that I promised. It is 1599 is the promo code, and that is available in North America only, and that will give you a discount on some chemistries and supplies, and there are limitations and instructions that apply. You can check with your sales rep or online. Okay, that's all we have for now, and please make sure that you subscribe to the Peak Tales podcast so you never miss an episode. Bye for now.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Peak Tales. For more information on what was discussed today, contact your local Agilent representative or go online to agilent.com.